Anne and Bill Heffernan. They had two adopted children. Scott, I believe, was the name of one of them. I believe he's made it through the world and done very well, educated and all kinds of things. In fact, I think there was an article about him in Improvement Era or Ensign or something one time. The little girl was not too alert mentally. I think her name was Deborah. I'm not sure on that. I don't know what's ever happened to her. Anyway, we were having a fireside one night at someone's home. I think it was at the home of Ashworth's. Clint Ashworth and his wife, who used to sing so beautifully. What was her name?
Rachel.
Rachel Ashworth. I think that's where this fireside was. I had invited Francis Bundy, one of my colleagues there at General Electric Company, who was interested in sailplaning gliders, to come and tell about sailplaning, hoping to get him a little interest in the church. While he was about in the middle of his talk, word came to us that Ann Heffernan had died. His wife had suddenly died. And so we rushed out there. Her mother was in the Relief Society. I think she went out with someone else who was in the Relief Society. And really quite a shocking experience. She was such a fine woman. As a note of interest, one of Ann Heffernan's best friends was Elaine Maddock, wife of Russell Maddock, who was a counselor. Russell was a counselor to me, along with a fellow named Christensen, forgotten his first name, when I became the Sunday school superintendent on first going to Schenectady. Russell is now still working for General Electric down in Roanoke, Virginia area, and he's been stake president down there for a long time.
I saw them when I went to the temple last.
Anyway, Elaine was the closest of any of the women to Anne. And Elaine had a vision, a revelation one night. Anne appeared to her and asked Anne to go do her temple work immediately. You know, you usually wait for a year after someone dies. She, on account of Bill's word of wisdom problem, he'd talk about going to the temple, but would never happen. Well, she took this to President Taylor. President Taylor, forgotten his first name, he was the mission president of Eastern States during the latter part of the time, at least, that we were in Schenectady. And he consulted with church authorities on the basis of this very special thing that had happened. Her temple work was done. Since they went on vacation, to Salt Lake City, they did Ann's temple work. Bill got a housekeeper who we believe was his mistress, and sort of went his way. Didn't see much more of the church after that time. Bill later on died. I don't know when he died, but he did die somewhere along there. Another sad thing. There was a young couple in our ward, Junius Aldridge, we called him Hap, and Velma Aldridge. Velma Aldridge had taken some dance, and she was teaching Charlene and some of our other kids to dance on occasion. Is that right?
Yes, but she's also our primary leader. That's how I remember her,
too. She's the kids' primary leader. A fine young couple. All kinds of promise. And Hap was one of these young man that looks like the ideal young American man, you know, handsome, vigorous, muscular, and tall. He had been in the service somehow, or with the National Guard or something. And the time would have been around 1951, or perhaps 52. And he was called back into the reserve. The Korean War had started. And he was a jet pilot. And before he had to go in the service, and they were course, he was going to go in the service somewhere in the east, and she was going to go back home. She was from Tustin, California, as I remembered her, somewhere in that area. At times, I guess they lived in Arizona, and I think that Hap was, yeah, I know that Hap was from somewhere in Arizona, probably from the Tempe area, Phoenix. We held a party for the ward, for them, the night before he had to leave, and we had a good time. And the last ones, they weren't the last, I don't know. Anyway, at one point, Hap and Velma left. And I remember Hap, he had a hat on, and he stood on our front porch of our white house with its red shutters. And he gave the very famous MacArthur salute that MacArthur gave when he was forced to leave the Philippines. He said, "I shall return," or "I will return," one or the other, and a certain salute with a hat somehow about it. Anyway, he gave that. But the sad thing was that Hap Aldridge did not return. Some months later, his jet plane disintegrated over some swamps down in the southern part of the country, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, somewhere. And they never were able to find his full remains. This was in the early days of jet engines, and they had not developed the very fine high-temperature alloys that they now have for turbine blades. And it happened too frequently that the engines on those Pioneer jet engines that were used in warfare, Korean War, would just plain fall apart. They couldn't stand the heat. Couldn't stand the temperature, didn't have the strength, they'd break, and of course cause the ruin of an airplane that might be traveling near the speed of sound. We've seen Velma occasionally, not many times through the years. She never did remarry. We saw many missionaries who passed through the Schenectady area, particularly when we lived on Bedford Road. We very well remember an Elder Hicken, who was an older 70, sent by his ward during the Korean War period when they didn't have young men to send out. He left his family in the Heber area and a florist business, which I believe he had, and came as a very effective missionary in the Schenectady area. We also had an Elder Jones, Ray Jones, who was a very effective and good missionary. We saw several sisters. I've forgotten the names of some of those sisters, but... Sister Tanner, we remember very well. Very pretty, talented, and very good missionary. Some of the missionaries were not so good. We often had dinner with the missionaries at our home on Bedford Road. This Ray Jones later on went on a second mission, I think, to one of the Scandinavian countries. He never did marry, and when we moved back to Provo, we found that he was teaching dramatic arts, debate, and things along that line at Provo High School, and he still does this to this day. And I think every one of our kids have had him for a teacher in debate or dramatics or something and have appeared in plays. I know Charlene and Tracy did, and probably some of the other kids. He also often takes school district worldwide tours. He was one of the escorts on a European tour, which Nancy went on a few years ago. Ray Jones was the one in charge of that particular European tour. We had lots of fundraising things to build the chapel. We had lots of bake sales. One very well-remembered project was the making of Christmas tree wreaths. I think Bill Heffernan had this idea, and it seemed we made those by the thousands. I'm sure we didn't, but it sure seemed that way. We bought all kinds of boughs and trimmings and whatnot, and spent no end of time making these wreaths and trying to sell them. I think that was one of our earlier projects. I think we did this at a home that was rented there in the downtown part of Schenectady by Wayne Wiscombe. There was an inter-church basketball team or tournament sponsored by the YMCA in Schenectady sometime during the earlier years that we were there. I would guess maybe around 1951 or so that I can remember. Some of our guys had played on young men's teams in the Mutual back home and were pretty good. We may even had a guy or two who may have played on a high school team. But for years, one of the churches there, I think a Baptist church team, had been the championship and nobody could ever beat them. On learning of this, these young LDS guys decided they could probably put together a team that could beat this outfit. And so I remember Wayne Wiscombe and some of the other more athletic guys were on that. I was even on the team as a substitute. I think I got to play for about a minute and a half. Didn't do any good, didn't make a basket. I do think I got one shot of the basket. But anyway, the Latter-day Saint team did win that year, which was a real turnover for the situation. They may have played some other years. I didn't play with them. But I know that it wasn't hard for the Latter-day Saints to put together a top-notch basketball team in those days with just a little bit of practice, say like about 1 week before the tournament started. One time, I remember that either BYU or the University of Utah was playing in Madison Square Garden in the National Invitational Tournament. Wayne Wiscombe promoted a scheme where half a dozen of us would get in somebody's car and go down to Madison Square Garden, leaving after work, get down there in time for the game, and come back. And I don't remember who won or anything else, but I do remember we did go down to Madison Square Garden in New York, and that's a good 3-4 hours drive in those days. There were no freeways. And then see the game and come back was a rather grueling time, but interesting to go down and see. I wish I could say that it was the BYU team and they won the tournament that year, but I've just forgotten. I don't know who won or how or what. While we loved the beautiful trees and the flora and the fauna that grew so profusely in New York State, by the way, the trees that grew in our own backyard in the woods behind us were on land that was our deed on our lots went back to the Shakers. The Quaking Shakers were the people who were on that land in the area where we lived in earlier times.
That's where the berries all came from.
Yeah, that's where the berries came from. And we thought that maybe those blackberries were not truly wild berries, but were just remnants that had existed over the years from something the Shakers may have planted. We always got our Christmas trees out of the forest behind us. You never went to buy a Christmas tree, or seldom did. The thing we missed was the coolness you could get by going into the mountains. We thought, oh, we'll get down there in this area in these high places in what they called mountains, which to us were mainly just hills. But it wasn't any cooler. You could find the highest place you could find on the map and go there, and you'd have that hot, sticky, humid situation just as characteristic of summers in this part of the world. As a matter of fact, that's the way it is right here now at Shirlene's. No air conditioning, just hot, sticky, muggy weather. 80 degrees here in the humidity feels as bad as 100 degrees back in Provo where it's dry. We saw many nearby places when we were in New York, trips to Albany where sometimes we'd have conference. There was just a small Albany branch. Troy had no branch at that time. We would sometimes go out in the country, see the country fairs. I don't know how many times we may have got to New York City or places like that, but when it became apparent we were going to leave and go back west, then we had to hurry up and see some things real fast. So we took our four oldest children. I guess Charlotte would have been the baby then. And left her with some friends and took the four older children, went to New York City and went to Washington, D.C. to see all the sights. We went to the top of the Empire State Building. We went on the subway. We went over and climbed up into this arm of the Statue of Liberty inside and saw the other sights and sounds of New York City. In Washington, D.C., we, of course, saw the Washington Monument, the Jefferson Monument, and the words on the Jefferson Monument give me a thrill every time I go in there and read the words that are written on the wall there that are due to Jefferson. Gets a lump in my throat to do that. We saw the White House and the Capitol buildings and went inside and all the other things around there. We took the kids to see. Hurry up job before we left the eastern part of the country. I had seen many of these things myself traveling to meetings for the General Electric Company. I had opportunity to do things like that. Charlene wouldn't remember it, but she was at the top of the Empire State Building when she was probably about 2 years old. We passed through New York City on the way from Hollywood, Florida to Brunswick, Maine. Had a stop over there between trains, and we took Charlene, who was dressed in a little suit that covered you all for the wintertime, it's wintertime weather, with one of these hats that you can fold down behind your neck or up on top of your head with a point on it. And I remember grabbing that whenever she'd try to get too far away from us in the New York City crowds. I'd just grab hold of that top part of her blue keep warm outfit, zippered up the front, you know, tied around the neck, went clear down to her feet. But I held her out over where she could look down to the street below and about gave Mom fits to have Charlene hanging over the ledge a little bit so like she could look at the ants, what looked like ants, cars, and the people on the street down below.
Oh, that makes me sick, too. Boy, you pick up more dirty words around here, but you didn't know dirty.
We purchased our first new car living in New York. It was a 1950 Ford two-door sedan. And as I remember it, the color of it was green. It was a beautiful thing. We got a loan on it at the Schenectady Bank. Interest rates were low in those days. On your savings account, you get 1.5-2%. We had 4.25% loan on our home mortgage, and on the automobile, I think that it was only about a 5%. We bought this car for only $1,450, which was a real bargain. I may be mixed up on the color of the car because we had two cars in short succession. In 1950, we took this Ford and went home to Utah on vacation driving this car. We had 2 weeks vacation accrued time per year in those days, so we'd have to wait 2 years and accumulate 1 week, which you could do, so we would have 3 weeks vacation, and you could go to Utah every other year and take 3 weeks. It would take 5 days to drive each way, so you didn't have too much time in Utah when you got there. Coming back from Utah, we're driving late at night, hoping to find an inexpensive motel and not finding any. We decided we'd try and sleep in the car off the road somewhere in the vicinity of Atlantic, Iowa. And we'd driven up and down the roads. They were narrow and muddy. They'd had a big rainstorm in the area, and we couldn't seem to find a place that looked like it'd be suitable to try and spend the night without being molested somewhere off the road, try and catch the sleep in the car. We didn't find anything and decided we'd head back for the highway. And heading back towards the highway, I was too far to the right-hand side in some deep ruts that had been made by a previous vehicle. Fortunately, going along only about 15 miles an hour. Very dark night. And I rolled the car off the road.
And Mom had told you two or three times to quit being so close to the edge of the road.
Possibility. And the car rolled over once and landed straddling a little tiny stream. Boy, I was so scared when that happened. I had visions of rolling into a big lake or a big river or something. The car was really not damaged. The kids were shaken up just a little bit, started to cry, but really scared. When the car alighted there and I could see that there was no blood and we weren't in a lake, I just grabbed Mom and hugged her, and we hugged each other and said a prayer. Really, right then, you know, thanking the Lord for saving us. Well, I went back to the main highway, which is, I would judge, about a mile from there, and tried to flag cars down. Nobody wanted to stop that late at night. It was at least 10, maybe 11 o'clock at night, and had a hard time getting anybody to stop, understandably. Finally, somebody stopped and rolled the window down an inch, and I told them of my difficulty and asked them to go call the police. And they called the police, and actually they came back with the police to see what had happened. We were really short on money and didn't know how. We could hardly even stay in a motel or anything. We stayed in the motel that night while we tried to decide what to do. They came with a wrecker and pulled the car out of there. As they were pulling it out, one of the cables snapped, and one of the policemen who'd come out was standing too close, and that cable hit him on the back of the neck, and he had to go to the hospital. I never did know the full final story of that, but we took the car to a place to be fixed. And I forget how much they wanted, but it turned out that it was an awful lot of money, more than I thought it should be. But finally, we talked to somebody and says, look, that car's drivable. Just wire those two doors together that won't close and be on your way. So finally, that's what we did. We called Ida Rose's father, Ernest F. Langford, in Ogden, and got him to telegraph us a couple of $100 so we could get out of there and finish our trip. We got back to Schenectady, and you see, the Korean War had broken out, and cars suddenly started to get real scarce. And I could not get a new car. Having this car be so new, I hated to just get it fixed. It was not particularly scratched, but the body was just deformed everywhere. We just rolled slowly over this embankment, over some small willows and trees, and it was bent in almost anywhere you tended to look, but it was not scratched or mangled. But I hated the thoughts of having a new car, you know, our first new car. I wanted to trade it in on a new one immediately. We could not do that around there, no way. But we had a friend whose name I've forgotten who had moved from Schenectady into Detroit. We called him on the phone to see if he could get us a car in Detroit, and he found that he could. Now, we had to sell our old car and get the cash in order to be able to buy the one which we had to pay cash for in Detroit. And someone had set us up with this dealer. He was a crippled man who seemed to be honest and upright and whatnot. And he had agreed to pay us a certain amount for this car and was going to meet us at the bank with a check. We went to the bank. We waited and waited. He showed up 5 minutes before the bank was due to close, and we had to carry on the transaction there at the bank. And then he started to try and beat us down on what he'd said he'd give us. And we would not have had the money to gone to Detroit. And that was so traumatic, this guy who had agreed to do this and then try and beat us down on the price. But I could not come down on the price, and so We just stayed there even after the bank was closed and they were trying to throw us out. I just insisted. Well, I had to. We had would not have had enough money to have gone to Detroit. And I had to catch the train. And he knew he had us over a barrel between the bank closing and my catching my train and whatnot. And he just stalled just like the unions do, you know, to the last bitter minute. But finally, I got the money out of him, and I got on the train, and I stood up on the train all the way to Detroit, no seat. I went there overnight, and looked this fellow up, and picked up a new car, and drove it back on graveled roads through Canada, and I had to stop and sleep in the car halfway on the way back. Now, this car was a different color, was identical model to our first one, different color.
This one was white.
Can't remember.
Was the first one green? The first one was creamish green and this one was white, the way I remember it, but maybe it was the other way around.
May have been the other way around. One of our cars was a pale green, a pale pastel sort of green, yeah. And the other one, I don't know, maybe it was white. And I don't know which came first. Anyway, we kept that car. When we left Schenectady, fan was getting big and a regular car wouldn't be big enough. We had to have a station wagon. We took out our retirement benefits. We lost everything that General Electric contributed and only got what we had put in during the years, which was $2,200. Went over to Albany and bought us a dark green, beautiful Ford station wagon. And it would seat 9 people. And we kept this car for, as I remembered, a total of 11 years. And that was our major car because there were 9 people in our family. 7 kids and 2 parents, and that car cost somewhere around $3,000 in 1955 when we bought it. Later on, we traded in the Ford. We got a green Chrysler, which we kept for 10 years. Other cars we've had a Valiant. We had a small Chevrolet. We currently have a yellow Ford. We had a little Fiat once. We've had a blue Chevrolet 3/4-ton pickup truck since 1970, and there was a time when we had 4 cars. We had the truck, the Ford, a Volkswagen, and the green Chrysler. But there were 5 drivers. That wasn't enough, so I had to ride my bicycle. When I interviewed for my BYU job as director of research, and that's the first position I held at Brigham Young University, it sort of happened like this. I had let Henry Eyring and some others learn that I wanted to leave General Electric, and the word finally reached BYU. Harvey Fletcher had retired from Bell Telephone Laboratories at 65 and had gone to teach at Columbia University. When he's 70 years old, Ernest Wilkinson invited him to come to BYU. And at BYU, he served as Dean of the College of Physical Science and Engineering and also the university's Director of Research. This was too much work, and they wanted to split the job in two, have a separate Director of Research. So I received a call from Ernest Wilkinson some point along asking me to come at the university's expense, go to conference, it was conference, general conference time, and interview for the job. Well, I went out to BYU and it was a beautiful, clear day like some of those April days can be where there's a slight breeze and lovely clouds in the sky and just absolute blue. Clear air and sky, and I just had to be on the campus and knew that, yeah, I'll go to work here. I was making a salary of, I don't know, $11,000, $12,000, $13,000, I think perhaps something close to $12,000. At General Electric, they offered me $7,500 at BYU, and I took it. At BYU, NERAD had told me to not take another job, to stick around. It might take him just a little while, but he could get me $20,000 a year. I never told him what I would make at BYU. I was afraid to tell him I was going out there for less money. Also, they offered me the position of manager of the diamond plant that they were going to start putting together and build in Detroit, Michigan. In those days, business was not my interest at all. I wanted to be a pure fundamental scientist in the main, although I had a real practical bent. I'd sort of got this attitude from my years with Eyring, when pure fundamental science was the real thing. This was hammered into the heads of university students all over the United States during that period of time, much to the detriment, I think, of our country. The truly good scientists who bring good things to mankind seems to me have a practical bent in addition to having pretty good theoretical knowledge. But it was sort of the teaching of the day that ivory tower, blue sky, fundamental research was the only thing that a great scientist ought to be doing. Anyway, at BYU, Harvey Fletcher told me I could have either job. I could be the dean or I could be the director of research. Well, research seemed to be closer to what I liked, so I took that particular job. It did not have the prestige that being the dean would have, but at least it would be closer to what I loved. Being the dean would just be no end of paperwork. Well, it turned out there became more and more paperwork.